Paul Eichen and others, appellants versus Wayne Township and the Wayne Township Volunteer Fire Department. For the appellants is Mr. Aaron Solberg, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees is Mr. Douglas Ebert, an attorney from Sioux Falls. I know we've had some students arrive after the first and possibly the second oral argument, so the court would once again like to welcome today students from the following high schools: Parker, Alcester, Flandreau, Dakota Valley, Rutland, Lincoln High School, Mitchell Christian, Mount Vernon, Woonsocket, Garrettson, Baltic, Sioux Falls Christian, and Lincoln. Also students from USDSU and Augustana. Mr. Solberg, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Aaron Solberg. I represent the appellants Paul Sharon, Jim John, and Eric Eichen. There's two matters before the court today. The first is whether the township, Wayne Township, and the Wayne Township Volunteer Fire Department showed as a matter of law that they were entitled to summary judgment on the basis of sovereign immunity. The second issue is whether the trial court appropriately granted a dismissal based on failure to prosecute. Before I get into those issues, this matter arises from a house fire on October 10th, 1998 in Eichen's home. Sharon detected a faint smell of smoke at about approximately 9:20 a.m., called 911 dispatch. 911 dispatch dispatched not only the Wayne Township Volunteer Fire Department, but they also dispatched Sioux Falls Fire Department, specifically Fire Station Number 6. The record indicates that Fire Station Number 6 is the Sioux Falls Fire Department is a professional firefighting organization. Record indicates that Wayne Township Fire Department is a volunteer organization. A minute after the 911 call, Wayne Township called Sioux Falls Fire Department off. They told them not to respond. Wayne Township responded to this fire 45 minutes after the call. On the way, they had also called the city of Hartford. Hartford is 20 miles away from the Eichen's home residence. The city of Sioux Falls Fire Department was only 2 miles away from the residence. So 45 minutes after the 911 call, the Wayne Township Volunteer Fire Department shows up. There is no debate on the record that weather conditions that day, that morning, were poor. That didn't stop Paul Eichen from driving home that morning. That didn't stop John Eichen from driving to his parents' house 1/2 hour after Wayne Township Fire Department showed up. Paul Eichen was fighting the fire with a hose, and he thought that he had been making progress on this. If you'll recall from the record, the Eichens didn't ever see a flame. It was only a light haze of smoke. Paul Eichen was fighting it with the fire with a garden hose, continued to do so until the fire department showed up. The fire department didn't have with it an axe. It didn't have with it a ladder. The one truck that did make it through was not primed. It couldn't pump water. Paul Eichen had to take the garden hose and prime the fire department's truck for them. It was 45 minutes before they were able to spray water on the house. In addition, they didn't have a saw. And the axe, the ladder, and saw are important because this house needed to be ventilated to help the firefighters fight the fire. The Eichens provided them a ladder. They provided them a grub axe. Grub axe wasn't sufficient to cut a big enough hole in the ceiling, so they provided John Eichen got the fire department saw for him. The saw didn't have the right blade in it. The Eichens changed that for him. The saw didn't have gas in it. The Eichens put gas in it for him. Then the saw didn't work. 11:30 that morning, some approximately hour and a half after they had arrived, the fire department then decides to go into the house. This is the first time that they had decided to go into the house to find out where the fire was. they need a push to go into the house, and by this time there's fire rolling out from underneath the eaves. Goes into the house, shows them how to get upstairs. They spray the one tanker truck of water that they do have on the roof. They try to hit the small hole that they had created in the roof. In the meantime, a Hartford truck had showed up. The first truck to arrive on the scene was a Wayne Volunteer Fire Department truck. There's some indication on the record that it slid into the ditch a little bit before making it to the Eichens house. That truck was a pumper truck that wasn't primed. They didn't call to anybody else responding to the fire and let them know that the road conditions were poor on that stretch of the road, if they were poor. The Hartford truck was the fourth or fifth to arrive. It slid off the road and it blocked the Eichens driveway. It blocked it so that there's no more water accessible to the driveway. Discussing the, turning to the issue of sovereign immunity, there's really two issues I'd like to discuss. And first is the one on whether they waived sovereign immunity. That issue is important because under the standards of summary judgment, I won't repeat them all to you, the township has the duty to show that there's no issue of material fact and that Wayne Township the fire department are entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
Now, my understanding is the trial court ruled on the summary judgment, but then later dismissed this case. Is that correct? Because it had not been prosecuted in a timely fashion?
Yes, Justice Meyer.
So isn't that the first issue we need to get, the first hurdle that you need to get over is the dismissal?
I'd agree with you.
So why should we reverse the trial court on that decision?
The Eichens had two attorneys in this matter. One was Mr. Joe Wassum, and one was Richard Johnson. Joe Wassum, in the trial court, there's affidavits from both of them. Joe Wassum was the lead attorney. Dick Johnson was there to assist Mr. Wassum. Mr. Wassum became ill. He was diagnosed with prostate cancer in December of 2004. He had treatment. It reoccurred in the early part of 2005, and he was unable to continue in this case. And the affidavits in the trial court state that he was unable to help out in this case.
Is there anything in the record that is attributable directly to your client's activities or inactivity? Or is it all the lawyers?
There is, Justice Meyer Henry. At the hearing, the transcript indicates that Mr. Johnson did state that my clients had no involvement in the delay. That was pretty clear on the record.
So there was nothing that your clients did fail to do that caused this delay?
No, my clients hired capable attorneys, and they relied on them.
So why did the trial court dismiss it?
The trial court, there's some confusion on the record under which statute the trial court dismissed it. Much has been made of this one-year period of inactivity, although the cases say that this is not the benchmark for dismissal.
But it was dismissed with prejudice.
It was, and under 15.641B, the dismissal is made with prejudice. It's on the merits. One thing I'd like to point out is in the brief it says that the standard of review is abuse of discretion. Now with 15.641B, I'd like to clarify that because it is on the merits, it's whether or not it's clearly erroneous. Now there were no findings of facts made in this case, and this court has to look at the findings of facts, conclusions of law to determine whether trial court's decision is clearly erroneous under 15.641B. Again, there was no findings of facts. I think the trial court relied heavily on that one-year period.
Which in that case, he should have just dismissed it without prejudice. if it was 11, right? If it was under the one-year statute?
There is a Swenson case that named in, or cited in the brief that addresses both issues or both statutes. The difference between this case and that case is that if you look at the record, there's two things. In that case, there were two periods of inactivity lasting a year or longer. Also, in that case, some of the activity that made up what this court relied on in reversing the dismissal, in the record, there were requests for admissions filed. There was depositions filed. We did those things in this matter, but as you know, the law doesn't allow us to file depositions anymore. If this case was decided on 15641B, the case law indicates under that statute purely that only 3 or 4 years is an unreasonable length of time. Under this statute, the test is whether the conduct was egregious. Under this statute, the test is whether the plaintiff's conduct was egregious. In this case, we have Attorney Johnson. I think he should be given quite a bit of credibility in this situation, is saying that this isn't his client's fault, that he was busy, that Joe Wasson was ill. They did interview a new expert witness. They did obtain more standards, firefighting standards, for the prosecution in this case within a year prior to the dismissal. There is activity. It's certainly not the plaintiff's fault that there was a delay. Attorney Johnson himself stated that he didn't know that Joe Wasson had become unlicensed, if he truly is unlicensed, until the day prior to this hearing.
Well, if you're saying it's not the plaintiff's fault due to delay, are you attributing any of it to the defendants?
To the defendants? Not directly. I will point out that there is no answer filed in this matter. There's no answer setting forth sovereign immunity. When we get back to that, I'll discuss that issue.
It was not raised in an answer? Sovereign immunity?
There's nothing in the record that shows that sovereign immunity was raised in the answer. There is a, there's no proof, proof of service of any answer in this matter. In the record, under civil procedure, the court needs to consider, back to the sovereign immunity issue, the court needs to consider the record, the pleadings, everything else. The court got a little ahead of itself here.
So it was never raised, and the court just raised it sua sponte?
No, the defendants filed a motion. They filed a motion based on 15656, motion for summary judgment. They served the briefs, but the briefs can't be considered on the record pursuant to civil rules of procedure.
Did they serve an answer on the plaintiffs?
It's not filed? It's not on the record, Your Honor. I can't tell you one way or another.
Well, then they apparently moved to dismiss before filing an answer. Is that what happened?
The plaintiffs moved to dismiss?
Or the defendants?
No, the summary judgment motion was first, and that's why I attempted to address it first. And then the motion to dismiss came later.
Okay.
How long a time between the summary judgment was decided till it was dismissed, roughly?
I believe we're at about a year, year and a half. Again, back to the dismissal, though. The cases indicate that 3 or 4 years is an appropriate amount of time for dismissal. There's certainly cases where the dismissal's out as far as 12 years.
But Rule 11 only requires 1 year.
Excuse me?
Rule 11 only requires 1 year.
Rule 11 does. There's no indication. In this case, the trial court's only explanation of which statute it found under was that there must be, and I'm quoting Judge Sell, there must be some reasonable explanation for the delay. There's no other indication which statute this is under. If you look at the appellee's brief for summary judgment, excuse me, to dismiss, you find that they distinguish both statutes and say that they're bringing it pursuant to 15641B. Now, under the Swenson case, the court won't assume that it's brought under both unless they do bring it under both, or that the judge rules under both if the appellee doesn't bring them under both.
So the procedure when this motion was brought to dismiss just cited 41B? Is that what you're saying?
The appellee's, no, the motion itself only cited 15656, motion for summary judgment.
Okay, but the motion to dismiss, where did that come from?
The motion to dismiss was filed with a memorandum of law.
Okay, and it cited which statute, 11 or?
It distinguished both, but it said specifically that we're bringing this motion pursuant to 15641B.
41B.
If there's no answer filed, no answer served, why didn't the plaintiffs move for default judgment?
I cannot tell you what was in the trial counsel's mind at that time, Your Honor.
There's no explanation in the record as to why there's no answer even served?
Maybe Attorney Dibert can enlighten us all on that issue, but I have not seen a thing in the record that say why there's no answer served. There's no agreement in the record. Attorney Dibert has in the record quite a few letters to support his motions. I've searched through all those, and there's no agreement to extend the deadline for the answer.
Well, when did you become involved in this case?
The day before the notice of appeal was to be served, okay, to be filed with this court. Going back to the motion for summary judgment based on sovereign immunity.
Define what sovereign immunity is for the benefit of the students.
The legislators enacted 2132A1, which states that public entities are immune from civil lawsuits to the extent that they purchase insurance or participate in a
except to the extent that they purchase insurance.
Excuse me?
Except to the extent that they purchase insurance.
Yes, Justice Sabres. Except to the extent that they purchase insurance or participate in a risk sharing pool. The legislator is very clear that it intended litigants to have their day in court if the township, in this matter, participate in a risk sharing pool or purchase liability insurance. Under sovereign immunity, Wayne Township has the duty to bring forth a prima facie case. There's only one time where a waiver was discussed, either in brief or by the court, and it had to do with Title 47 on volunteers, the court said. The court said that the township had waived the immunity under that statute because they failed to bring it up. So,
did discovery reveal they did not have insurance?
There's a letter in the record where Attorney Johnson asked Attorney Diver for their insurance limits. There's a response letter back saying, essentially, I don't want to quote, that no, we're not giving it to you. They essentially ignored it. If you look at
you have 2 minutes.
If you look at WM Columns, Inc., that case was a contract case. That case was a contract case where the plaintiff brought a motion for summary judgment, failed to show that a condition precedent had been met, and this court found that they hadn't made a prima facie case. Two other cases, Olson versus Town of Hurley and Cromwell versus Rapid City Police Department, those two cases found there is a waiver because they hadn't affirmatively shown insurance. In Cromwell, they had insurance, but they had lost it. They argued that they had relinquished responsibility by losing their insurance. In Olson, there's an affidavit in that case stating that it was denied insurance, and this court said that that doesn't tell us what extent of insurance you had in this matter. One further argument is that South Dakota recognizes, per Tipton versus Town of Tabor, the public duty rule with the special relationship doctrine. It sets out elements in there: actual knowledge of dangerous condition, reasonable reliance on representation or conduct by the public entity, failure of due care to avoid increasing harm. The actual knowledge in this case, Wayne Township's fire department was contacted by 911, dispatched out there. They had a house fire. They called off Sioux Falls.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Mr. Dibert, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, justices. May it please this court, Mr. Solberg. If I can correct, just to deal with the facts for just a minute, one of the significant issues that's attempted to be made here is the fact that Wayne Township called off, so to speak, Sioux Falls Fire Department. And there seems to be an undertone or overtone of the idea that there was some territorial issues at play here. If you look, however, at the affidavit of Greg Swenson, who was the fire department chief then, the reason they didn't call Sioux Falls Fire Department, specifically station number 6 at 12th and Marion, was Sioux Falls Fire Station number 6 did not have a tanker truck. One of the problems with fighting a rural fire is you don't have a continuous source of water, meaning fire hydrants. So the water has to be transported in tanks or tanker trucks. Swenson also knew, it's in his affidavit, that the only department in Sioux Falls, the only station, was at Cliff Avenue in Benson, quite a ways to the northeast. They had one tanker truck. He knew that Hartford was pretty much a push as far as the distance was concerned. Hartford had three tanker trucks. Now, that's probably not very important, since I don't believe any of these little things made a difference. And we may get to the expert witness's opinion, which was based on essentially nothing when he found out what the true facts were regarding weather. But I did want to make that point on facts. Justice Meyer Henry asked, first of all, about the motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution. Indeed, and I don't believe there is any confusion over that, we made the motion under 15.641B.
Did the trial court make findings under 41B?
The trial court did not, Justice Meyer Henry.
Do we need to remand it for that?
You may need to do that, and if you do, that's my fault. Frankly, I didn't even consider it. Knowing that under Rule 56, findings weren't necessary, I never thought about it. And I'd make this argument, too. There are only two real facts, both of which are not in dispute with regard to the findings the court might make. First of all, there is absolutely no dispute that 18 months and one day went by with no activity whatsoever. And Justice Meyer Henry, you asked about the time frame between the ruling on motion for summary judgment and the motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution. I believe Judge Zell's opinion on the motion for summary judgment was dated December 2 of 2003. The motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution was heard in August of 2005. I can use my fingers there. It's about 20 months, though. So there was a significant lapse of time. And by the way, in that time frame, the only three things that happened in early 2004, first of all, there was a demand made of $150,000. My letter, and I want to address this too, it's Index 207, and it's been portrayed as our refusal to reveal insurance. The other side knew there was insurance. There was never a formal request, request for production, interrogatories. There was insurance. I'll tell this court that. But the point I'm making is, in February of 2004, I authored two letters to the defendant, to the plaintiff. One of them specifically addressing, first said we couldn't deal with the demand. the other saying that, suggesting that we get a scheduling order. Nothing happened for 18 months, and I can't help but wonder if I hadn't made the motion, how much more time would have gone by, but there's no question about that. Second, I don't believe there's any serious argument as to the reasonable cause issue. Plaintiffs have now made the issue that somehow Joe Wassum's illness played a part in this. Joe Wassum wasn't lead counsel in this. Joe Wassum, I don't believe, ever tried a case. Dick Johnson was in this from day one, and you can look at the summons and complaint to determine that. Every letter was authored by him, every response to a motion. Dick Johnson was hardly a bit player. Besides that, the day before the motion for was heard on my Rule 41 or 641 motion, about 3 in the afternoon, a letter, affidavits were delivered to me indicating that part of the story was Mr. Wassum's illness. This is in my response affidavit. Checked on several things, and indeed, Mr. Wassum wasn't even an active member of the bar in 2005. So, putting this together, one more thing. At page 5 of the hearing transcript, Mr. Johnson specifically admitted that he really didn't have an excuse for the delay. Putting that together, Justices, there's no serious argument that there was any justification for the delay in this case.
The concern I have is that none of this delay was attributable to the litigants themselves. And now we are basically, they have no recourse on this deal. They're out because there was a delay by their attorneys. And aren't we setting here a pretty high bar for the attorneys, maybe, or whatever? Does this open Mr. Johnson to liability now?
You're probably correct, Justice Meyer-Henry, and I think if the court will look at the motions to dismiss, excuse me, your decisions on motions to dismiss for lack of prosecution, it's always the attorney, virtually always the attorney. It's a regrettable situation when one in my position has to make the motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution, but it's a defense. This court has frequently recognized it as a defense. It's part of our rules of order. And Justice Meyer-Henry, I have no other argument but that, or response to your comment, but indeed it probably would expose the attorney, and that isn't the first time it's happened.
Well, the concern I have here, too, is that there are no findings of fact. And really, with a 41B, when you dismiss with prejudice, there should be some egregious behavior here that somebody makes a determination on. We don't probably have your briefs that you argued to the trial court about that. I'm beginning to worry whether the trial courts are looking at this as a statute of limitations kind of thing and just throwing them out.
And I have no good answer for that, Justice Meyer-Henry. And again, I take full responsibility for the failure to have findings and conclusions entered. Once again, I'd make the argument that those two things, the time frame and the lack of any justifiable excuse for the delay, are absolutely uncontroverted, and findings of fact simply aren't necessary.
Let's discuss sovereign immunity for a minute. It is waived to the extent that there's insurance, correct?
Justice Sabers, let me say that I've had some number of cases before this court under 2132A situations. I made the argument at pages 27 and 31 of my brief that the volunteer aspect should constitute immunity. I'm withdrawing that argument. I was incorrect. There's a specific provision, a couple of paragraphs after that, that to the extent there's insurance, there is no immunity, and therefore we're not relying on that.
So the trial court was deadly wrong when he granted partial summary judgment on sovereign immunity, wasn't he?
I don't think so, Justice Sabers. If you look at Index 192, page 5 of Judge Zell's decision, he specifically ruled that he would not dismiss the case based on sovereign immunity. He made the statement that he assumes there was insurance. That is correct. So, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, but I just looked at that this morning, and I'm quite certain if you look at page 5, and again, Index 192 of the opinion, a sovereign immunity was not the basis for Judge Zell's decision.
Am I wrong then in thinking that the plaintiffs have appealed on the basis that sovereign immunity was improperly ruled?
They may have, but what I'm saying is I don't believe it's an issue for exactly those reasons.
That's not an issue anymore anyway, is it?
It isn't.
Okay.
One other point to be made. Plaintiffs have argued that this should be a 3 or 4 year situation before the court should consider dismissal. Tab 1 to my index lists the last 10 cases before this court between 1995 and 2003. And to go through those, here are the periods of inactivity. Genco, 2.5 years. Storm, 14 months. White Eagle, 1 year, 15 days. Moore, 14 months. Simpson, just over 1 year, unspecified. Schwartz, 13 months. Swenson, 21 months. London, 17 months. Devitt, 17 months. And Annette, 1 year, 15 days. So I would urge, and if I've counted wrong, I apologize, but the argument that this should require 3 to 4 years of inactivity, I would urge the court not to accept. One other point I want to make, and this is consistent with one of Justice Meyer-Henry's remarks, in this profession in which we are privileged to practice, we live by some number of rules. Many of those involve time frames and timeliness. And as Justice Meyer-Henry, you mentioned statutes of limitations. 2 years for a municipality, 3 years for personal injury, 6 years on a contract. There's a 180-day requirement of notice before a public entity may be sued. This court and the South Dakota legislature have just changed this year the time for appeal from 60 days to 30 days. And we could probably go on. All admittedly are somewhat arbitrary. Why isn't the statute for personal injury 4 years? Well, I don't know. And if someone misses the statute by 2 days, well, is it that big a deal? Well, probably not. But they provide the part of the predictability and order necessary for this system to function. Beyond that, the one-year rule is well known to every lawyer in this state. And perhaps that's because of this fact that, as I mentioned, this court has decided 10 cases between 1995 and 2003 on this very issue. 9 of those cases, as set forth in my little summary, have resulted in dismissal.
Were those with prejudice, do you remember?
Justice Meyer-Henry, I should have looked at that. I cannot recall if they were 15-11-11 or 15-641 motions. Regardless, and one other point to be made, a person in the defendant's standpoint does not need to wait for the court to make a 15-11-11 notice and a motion. The defense has the right under 15-641 to make the motion, as we did.
Should the dismissal be with prejudice or without prejudice?
Since it was made under 15-641, Justice Savers, I would urge that it should be with prejudice, which is what the trial court ruled. On the partial summary judgment ruling, and I would think that the argument on the motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution should trump that. As far as the trial court did go, those causes of action should have been dismissed based mainly on the expert witness that plaintiffs disclosed. And by the way, before I forget this, one of the other points to justify the delay was the fact that in December of 2004, plaintiffs' counsel were talking to a new expert. Well, their expert witness deadline was June 30th of 2002, which was 2.5 years, and this type of unilateral contact is similar to that in Holmo versus Royce, I believe was the case, and should not be considered. But getting back to the expert opinion, his name was John Woodward from somewhere south of Des Moines, Iowa. He had a written report, and it's a part of the index. And at, I believe it's pages 34 to 35 of my brief, I went through in a little bit of detail his testimony. And of course, I would urge, too, that expert testimony is necessary in a case such as this, something beyond the knowledge of the ordinary layman. Deposing Woodward, again, at pages 34 through 36 of my brief, I've quoted some of his testimony. I asked him what he assumed the weather conditions were that morning. He indicated he thought there had been, I believe, 6 inches of snow. It was slushy. Winds were not a factor, visibility not a factor. I asked him to assume, and what I used was Weather Bureau records, which I put in our statement of undisputed facts, hour by hour, on the horrific conditions that existed. And his testimony was, well, that's a whole new ballgame. That structure is going to wind up a total loss. And he said that several times, in effect admitting that his testimony, his opinions were based on nothing. That's a broad stroke on the motion for summary judgment.
So was that found to be an undisputed fact, the weather conditions?
The undisputed fact was there was no statement in opposition to the undisputed facts, as I recall that, Justice Meyer Henry, and that's at the summary judgment level. And in fact, we submitted with our statement of undisputed facts Weather Bureau records, or at least summaries, kept by the Sioux Falls Weather Station, which I believe was 7 miles from the scene of the fire, at 56 minutes after each hour, and sometimes more frequently they make those readings. So we think it was pretty solid. Plaintiffs certainly didn't quarrel with any of that. The mutual aid compact really hasn't been argued yet, although a semi-big deal was made out of that at the trial court level. If you look at that document, which is part of our appendix, it consists of 6 pages, 1.5 pages of text, and roughly 4.5 pages of signature. It has absolutely nothing in there which imposes any duty upon any entity to do anything, specifically in a response fire situation such as we have here. Which gets me to what I think is the last point I want to make in considering the motion for summary judgment, if we get to that. The discretionary ministerial function argument is substantial. At Judge Zell's opinion of December 2003, he made the remark that some of the things such as equipment, training methods, and such are ministerial in nature. They aren't anywhere close to that. These are exactly the types of discretionary functions set out, I think the last time was in the Wolf versus Sensed case, and before that in a footnote that Justice Amundson had to the Kelo versus Panzer case. No one has pointed to any document, a rule, standard, or anything else that sets a standard for a rural fire department so far as its training and or equipment are concerned. So we would urge that that really isn't an argument to be considered. We don't believe the special duty test comes into play here. This court is well aware of it, as am I, of the two Tipton cases. Those four tests don't come into play at all. Besides that, as far as this court has gone on the special duty test, there is first a requirement, and in the Tipton case it was the enactment of the ordinance. There has to be something to refer to before you get to the special duty test. It doesn't simply exist in a void. Here, there's nothing of that in the record. Unless there are questions, to conclude, the case was properly dismissed on summary judgment. That decision should be affirmed by this court. And unless the court has other questions, I have nothing to argue.
I have one question. Is the dismissal then, there are no other causes of action still out there, is that right?
That is correct.
So the case is over either way here, is what you're saying. If we affirm the revert or the dismissal, and if we don't affirm the dismissal, we go to the summary judgment and it's over. Is that right? If we rely on your, or if there, we agree with you.
Besides the three bases that the summary judgment was granted, Judge Zell held there were two other theories on which plaintiff could proceed.
Okay, so then there would still be some causes of, or theories to proceed.
And again on that, not to be redundant, but the opinion of Mr. Woodward wouldn't withstand that, since he admitted, based on the terrible weather conditions, his opinion was no good anyway.
What are those two theories?
One of them, I believe, was training, of which there was no evidence. The other was equipment, of which there was no evidence, and both of which I believe would be discretionary functions. And I'm glad you mentioned that, Justice Savers. In the opinion, Judge Zell, in a sense, sua sponte, mentioned that those two grounds might survive.
But if I recall, you did not file a notice of review on that.
I did not, Justice, and you know.
So those actions are still alive if the motion to dismiss is not sustained.
Correct. Justice Gilbertson, Justices, thank you for your time and attention. It is always a privilege to appear before this court.
Thank you, Mr. Deibert. Mr. Salberg, you have 10 minutes, sir.
It's just a, if it may please the court, there's just a few things I want to clear up. There was a decision by the Wayne Township Volunteer Fire Department to call off Sioux Falls, and it's claimed that decision was based on the need for water tankers. The problem with that, the problem is that the record does not show that the Wayne Township Fire Department was even on the scene at that time. What they knew is that there was a structure fire. They didn't know how big. They didn't know if they needed water.
Kind of a fire wouldn't you need water for?
Oh, for example, if the stove's on fire and tenant or the homeowner puts it out himself. There are many false calls. Perhaps they didn't need to call Sioux Falls off at all. Perhaps this house structure was caused by hazardous material for which they needed Sioux Falls Fire's expertise instead of another volunteer fire department's assistance. We're talking about Greg Swenson, the acting fire chief, his dad being the fire chief, who wasn't on scene for 2 hours until after this started. The case is cited by the appellee in this matter for the one-year time frame. They all have some common elements. If the cases were decided under 3 or 4 years of no activity, they're based either on 15-11-11, or if they were based on 15-641-B, it was because it was for a failure to follow a discovery order. There was another statute involved in there for failure to make the plaintiff in that another case failed to make 6 calendar calls. There is no case cited in either the appellant's or the appellee's brief under 15-641-B strictly that has less than a 3 or 4 year time frame of inactivity. This would be the first.
What about all the cases that Mr. Deibert read off to us?
The Potts case, there was a 4 year delay. That's a very old case. I can't tell you which statute that's under. The Walkins case is under 15-641-B. That's a 3 year period, but that plaintiff missed the 6 calendar calls. There's the Fox case, 41-B, a 4 year delay. Duncan, 41-B, a 4 year delay. Reed was 15-11-11, again a 1 year delay. Homo was a 4 year delay. Dakota Cheese was 15-11-11. That was, I believe, a year. DeVitt versus Hay, there's 1 year of activity, no excuse under 15-11-11. White Eagle was 1 year and 15 days. Again, we have 15-11-11.
What about Annette?
Excuse me?
What about Annette?
We have a 1 year delay with no activity at all and 2 years of virtually nothing, completely. I believe Annette was under 15-11-11 too, if I recall correctly.
But here there's no dispute of fact about 18 months of delay and 2 failures to even respond to defense counsel's letters and nothing else that really counts to stop the running of the delay. Isn't that, there's no dispute about those facts, are there?
If we're talking about no record activity, you're correct, Your Honor. If we're talking about no activity, no. Within 8 months, there was activity between the plaintiff plaintiff's counsel and their expert. They were lining up the expert. After the motion for summary judgment, obviously, and I'd like to talk about the motion a little bit more, obviously there is a need for some more assistance. Now, for the appellee to say that this motion for some summary judgment was based on the expert is a bit misplaced. Judge Zell's opinion does not talk about the motion being based on that at all. In fact, Judge Zell read over John Woodland's deposition and found that he had expertise in a level. He had part of the record is John Woodland's professional curriculum vitae. It indicates that Woodland had 9 years' experience as a firefighter, two of which he served as assistant chief. He's had training and education in both insurance and arson investigations. Judge Zell had no problem with his opinions. And while we're on that point, it's difficult for me to say, although I will, that an expert is needed to tell somebody that, or to tell a jury, that a fire department should show up with an axe, that a fire department should show up with a ladder, that their truck should work. You know, in this case, Paul Eichner was trying to fight the fire with the garden hose. He was retained by the sheriff at the direction of Wayne Township and told that he'd be arrested if he didn't. Now, when we're talking about the special duty, there's a static case that I cited in my brief, very similar to this case. Individual is trying to rescue their wife from a burning fire. The wife died in the fire. The fire department in that case had retained, had the man arrested. That case, the primary factor that they focused on was reliance on the firefighter. In this case, Paul Eichner had no other choice but to let them attempt to try to fight this fire. The appellees argue that there's an ordinance or something that's required. If we looked at Tipton, there's a four-part test, and the requirements of an ordinance is only one of the four-part tests, and Tipton says not all four are necessary. You look at the Stata case, the one that they focused on primarily was the reliance on the victim, the reliance on the victim on the fire department. You look at the other cases cited in Appellee's brief that talk about ordinance. What we're really getting down to here, we have this duty, public duty, special relationship distinction. We're basically going straight back to traditional properties of tort liability. We're going back to foreseeability. The cases cited by the appellees talk about highway commissioners with thousands of miles worth of road that they're supposed to supervise with hundreds of employees. The foreseeability is questionable in those circumstances when you have the statute. It's not a surprise that this court has found that the public or the commissioner of the highways isn't liable for putting up a sign on one of the thousands of miles worth of highway. This court's consistently held that you can't create a public or a private right of action through an ordinance. This court's been consistent on this case. However, we do have Tipton, and we have the special relationship doctrine, and in Tipton.
You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. The final point on the motion to dismiss is that there was no prejudice shown by the appellees. They didn't bring it up. There was not a mention of the word prejudice. Now, this isn't a determinative factor, but it is a factor. The appellee cited CNR Supply. In that case was decided on 15-11-11. There was no dismissal in that case under that statute, although there was a 15-month delay. One of the factors that this court focused on in that case, per the appellee's submission in their brief, is that there was no prejudice. The trial court certainly have a less drastic sanction than taking the Eichner's case away from them. They have the right, the trial courts have the discretion, the apparent authority to this out a scheduling order. They have the apparent authority to send notice, and in fact, I'm aware of two courts in the state that will send out a 15-11-11 order saying, we're going to dismiss your case if you don't show us just cause why it shouldn't be dismissed. This thing's been lingering too long. This wasn't done in this case. The Aishans had no fault of their own in this case other than relying on their attorneys. Laymen naturally are going to rely on their attorneys. They have no fault. They had no notice that they were at risk of their case being dismissed. And on that point, I understand that this court doesn't criticize anybody for ending early, and I'm going to do that.
And you will not be criticized. Thank you, counsel.